For July the 18th, 2014, we talk about the Wii U's virtual console problems, Long Live the Queen, and we interview the developer of Beyond Eyes. Welcome to the 68th level. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you're listening to The Level. It's a podcast for people who love video games. Guys, we're recording at a weird time.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what's happening.
In a weird place.
It means I'm actually awake while we do this.
I know. It means that if we, unlike every other podcast I record, this isn't going to end with, I need to go to bed. No shit. We recorded the Bonfireside chat that just came out this week. Today, due to scheduling conflicts, we were talking with the community manager at Bandai Namco, and things slipped through. We ended up having to record that starting at midnight my time on a work night. Yeah.
Is that person in Japan? Is that the reason for that?
No, he's in California, but just we tried getting him on earlier and it didn't work. Like there was no audio. And it's like, well, there's nothing really we can do aside from do this. So I took that bullet. I was Looney Tunes. I had to edit out so many me not finding words.
You paid for it. I don't know how you got up for work the next day. Like I've had late nights like that where it's like, hey, it's 4 a.m. I'll just power through, and it like my body does not get out of bed. I don't wake up. I'll sleep through any alarm, any shaking, anything like that.
No, and those are the, you know, as a 26-year-old person, it is hard for me to say like, oh, I can tell I'm getting old, but like that, the whole not being able to recover from a late night. And also the fact that I get hangovers wicked easy now. Just like, okay. Yeah, like that is the vanguard of far more disturbing changes coming down the line.
Yeah. I think that going to work after getting like less than 3 hours of sleep is like playing quap, you know? Like trying to manage your functions.
Yeah.
All right, I got to turn the keys in my car now. All right, let's do this.
Yeah. Yeah, especially if your job involves talking with people, it really does get it gets hairier and hairier the worse you get. Oof. Yeah, but we're recording at an odd time today because this is a very special episode. Instead of a multiplayer portion,
eating dinner, I'll be eating breakfast.
Yeah, brunch. I'm polishing off some mimosas.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I had cantaloupe in my mouth. Yeah. Brunch jokes. Yeah, so Ben is not eating right now, which is an exciting new change for us. Also exciting is the interview that we have replacing the multiplayer segment with the developer of Beyond Eyes, which is an awesome looking indie game, Sherida Halito, who joins us to talk about the process of making kind of one of the more innovative indie games I've seen in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So other than that, though, we're going to do a brief brief and a brief grind. And smacked in between those is going to be that interview. Does that sound good to you guys?
Sounds great. Let's get through this other crap so we can get to that interview. I want people to hear it.
Yeah. It's time for the brief where we talk about things that are happening in this world around us. This is probably going to be very short because there hasn't been a lot of time since we last recorded, so there wasn't a lot of room for events to happen. However, you know, give us some kind of break if Apple buys Nintendo or something like that between now and Friday. So,
this is way in advance.
Does anybody have a story? No.
Mine was the interview as of right now. Fiercely searching IGN.com and Polygon.com.
Furiously.
Google, frantic Google. Yeah, no, I spent all my time before the podcast trying to prepare for Beyond Eyes because I wanted to be as informed as possible for that interview.
Huh, makes sense.
So we could make this a brief and just have Cole go.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so some weird news about the virtual console. There's an interview that was put out, basically like a Twitter question from, let's see here, the guy who runs Nintendo's virtual console department, Yosuke Ukunare, who responded basically saying, yeah, Sega really doesn't have any plans to bring its games to Wii U. So like talking about let's see here, the you know, versions of like Outrun and Space Harrier, which were brought to 3DS. The you know, the idea is they just really don't want to put their stuff on Wii U, even though they already have that stuff available on the Wii Virtual Console. And that brings out like a bigger problem with this whole thing, which is, why the fuck is that an issue? Why can't you just take the shit from one place and put the shit in the shit?
What is the Wii U operating on? Like, does it have some sort of proprietary operating system?
I mean, kind of, but not really. So, like, it will run. So if you bought a Virtual Console game on your Wii, there's like a little migration assistant that brings all of that stuff over to the Wii U. However, that runs in an emulator that emulates the environment from the original Wii.
Gotcha.
Okay. I just don't see why there's a distinction other than like legal stuff. So it was already kind of, you know, sketchy when they're like, okay, we're gonna second verse same as the first, second system here, Mega Man's coming out again, have fun guys.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, this is something I think we speak ill of when the at its inception of, it's like, all right, now are we gonna have to rebuy our entire library every console generation? That's kind of,
yeah,
a poor alternative to Steam.
Little bit, yeah. And that's an even bigger problem with, you know, what are we looking at here, the PlayStation 4 not running any PSN stuff, the idea that you're going to have to subscribe to PlayStation Now to make any of that happen. It's just kind of a bummer, and you're right, like this Steam is leading the way on this insofar as I can play games I bought 10 years ago, you know, downloaded, but I can't on my Wii or whatnot. From generation to generation. Yeah. That preservation thing is so important.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It, you can see why it's not smart as a business move, but also alienates people, so that could be a bad business move as well.
Yeah, what's bad for the customer, what's bad for the consumer, is bad for your business.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. Yeah. So that's really the only news story that I've seen in the past couple of days.
So I have a story, but it's more just an excuse for me to complain. So
what do you think that was?
Yeah. This happens all the time. So, and it'll be over by the time people hear this. But, you know, the PlayStation Store is doing another flash sale where they've got, I think, 20 plus games for 99 cents each. Which is fantastic, kind of talking about Steam, that other services are starting to catch up to Steam, especially for Xbox and for PlayStation. They seem to be finally getting with the program. And they're good games, like Machinarium is on there, Dyad, where's the other one? So it was Poppy Yo, The Cave, Thomas Was Alone, like a ton of really good games for 99 cents. My complaining part, and I can't remember if I've talked about this on the show before, is that PlayStation Network still has a $5 minimum purchase.
What?
Yeah. So I see these sales all the time, and they sell games for 99 cents. Brilliant. And then I go in and, like, actually wanting to buy, let's call it four of the games, and it won't let me do it. Like, it's the weird, not quite Spacebucks, but you have a quote-unquote online wallet that you have to add funds to, and then you purchase out of that wallet.
Yeah.
So anything over $5, it just automatically adds the amount that you want and then deducts it out. So why is it even there? But if you try to buy less than $5 worth of stuff, it tells you you must add at least $5 to your wallet, which means that you could spend...
$5 to your wallet or $5 to the purchase that you're
on
making?
On a transaction.
To your wallet. So you don't necessarily have to spend $5, but you have to add $5. And then I can find there's no way to get it off there once you've put it in.
Yeah.
Well, that's even more confusing.
Yeah. Well, that's also not a new problem. I mean, you can't buy if you're trying to buy a Wii Virtual Console game that is 500 points, you can't just put in $5 and take that out. No, you have to buy at least $10 worth of points. This also used to be a big issue with Xbox 360. Like when you say it's not quite Spacebucks, it's exactly Spacebucks. Because because, you know, before they fixed their pricing, like when the the system first came out, you could only buy in like $20 intervals, and stuff like, okay, so it was either $5, $10, or $20, and there was stuff that was like, okay, here's $12. Well, shit, it might as well just cost $20 because that's what you're putting into it, and you're going to have remainders. I've had 50 cents sitting on my Xbox Live account balance for, let's say, 8 years now. Because just because what the fuck am I going to spend 50 cents on? Something caused that differential and it's never going to be resolved again. So I might as well have just lent Microsoft 50 cents.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Lent it's or really... give.
Well, I mean, it's mine. You can get it back anytime you want.
How though? Like, they bury that so deep.
Well, no, like, no, you can't. I mean, it's still technically funds that I could use just on nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And again, yeah, technically, you know, I buy stuff from PlayStation Network all the time, so I will probably wind up using that money one way or another. But it's just, it's so frustrating, and it's such a, like, treat your consumer like your enemy that needs to be tricked kind of move. Really, really disappointing. So, and again, the flash sales just stand to highlight it, which which is super annoying. Thankfully I have most of the games that are on sale, so that's, you know, not a problem. But I would go and pick up Poppy EO for 99 cents in a heartbeat if I could spend 99 cents on it. As it is, I'm probably gonna let it pass.
Sad. Also, a thing that's bullshit, I'm looking on here, Machinarium PS3, Machinarium PS Vita. Why are those different purchases, dogs?
I think it's cross buy.
Is it?
I think so. I'm not certain. They could be doing something wonky for the flash sale, but I know when it was on PlayStation Plus, you could get it for both.
But yeah, I'm happy I found out about this because both Dino Crises are on sale.
I have no experience with those games.
That's Resident Evil, but with dinosaurs. It's not great, but I'm going to need them for X-Crank eventually. So.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. Ben, how about you?
So I actually have a nice segue. I have like a brief, but that's not worth doing. I have a good segue into the grind, though, so I think we should go that direction.
Okay, so you'll do the segue, and then we will also we will wait 40 minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want to do your segue when we get back?
My segue is invalidated now.
I'm sorry.
Now I feel bad that I killed, off the cliff.
I feel bad that I killed your segue.
that
was important. A man died.
Yeah, all right. I thought that one was going to get swept under the rug. All right, I can do my brief. This is just a teensy little thing. And I think we had mentioned maybe foreshadowing of this before, but Lindsay Lohan filed a suit against Grand Theft Auto V for using her likeness without her consent. So she's claiming that one of the characters in the game is based on her.
Yeah.
So... a lawsuit is in action. That's all.
Why does this always happen with Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah.
Because I guess people can succeed in doing it, so...
Yeah. What was it? It was a member, not like a Wu-Tang Clan member, but like an early 90s rapper who sued them in 2010, like 5 years after San Andreas came out, for CJ's likeness being based off of him.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And
but
so,
I can't remember who it was.
So that's like the worst choice of a character to like claim likeness rights on, because he's the most variable.
Exactly.
Like, you can make him be huge weight. You can make him be ripped. You can make him be scrawny. But yeah.
I mean, but like the canonical CJ, like the one that they are using in marketing materials, he was arguing that it was based off of him.
Yeah. It's the thought process of, you know, you never sue the person that hit you. You sue the manufacturer of the car because they're the ones who have the money.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous because, I've played the game to a certain extent and I've encountered that character. And it's like, that doesn't read as a parody of her. Like, how self-centered is Lindsay Lohan that she thinks, an unreliable kind of drug addict actor? Like, it's just a parody of Hollywood movie stars, you know, who can't handle fame.
To be fair, I think Lindsay Lohan is... exactly that self-centered. So,
it was a rhetorical question, I assure you. Yeah, that's tough. I read her case, or at least things that were lobbied against it, and none of that seems specific to her. And even that character doesn't look an awful lot like her. Like, they just the character just looks like a white girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like, and it's a very sad thing for Lindsay, and, you know, but, you know, at that point, she doesn't need any more money. What she needs and what she cares about is having her name in the headlines. And that's what matters to her.
Yeah.
That's what she's become.
Yeah. Yeah, because that makes you more employable if you're litigious.
I think this is for that. That's what gets her off. That's what she cares about. Like, that's how she feels like she is a relevant human being.
That just reminds me of my favorite, one of my favorite Onion headlines, which is jurisprudence fetishist gets off on technicality.
Oh yeah, I remember seeing that. Excellent.
I don't know, but hey, all you have to do is just go after go after the biggest entertainment property of 2013. Here's the weird thing that I didn't realize until he showed up on the comedy button. Do you know? So the voice of the overweight stoner son of Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I forget the character's name, but he's like a punk. That is Danny Tamborelli, who was Little Pete from Pete and Pete. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
So, little trivia facts.
Nice.
Fun fact.
Fun fact.
I feel like that is Grand Theft Auto's, like, that's the essence of that game, is all the little, like, oh my god, that's that thing. Like, that's what makes the game so fun.
Yeah.
That and, you know, huge car explosions.
Yeah, I need to go back and beat that, like, real bad.
No one needs to beat a Grand Theft Auto 5 or
I'd like
Grand
to
Theft
see
Auto
the story.
4.
I'm curious about it. I want to get more of those heist missions. Those are fun.
Really?
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Yeah, those are the highlights of the game. Heist missions?
Yeah. I'll sit down to play Watch Dogs because that, you know, Dance with the One That Brought You, right? And you know, okay, I just, because if I put that down, it'll be like Grand Theft Auto and I will never touch it again, you know? So I want to nip that in the bud while I can with my new backloggery focus. And I sit down to play and it was like, I just think, man, I really wish I was playing Grand Theft Auto 5 because I could be Trevor right now. You know?
That's funny.
Yeah. Cool. Nice brief, guys. Why don't we talk to Sherida?
Yeah, let's. All right, so we are joined now by Sherida Halito, the developer of Beyond Eyes. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. First off, just a little bit of context for the listeners. You sent through a pre-alpha demo for this game for us to check out, and so we've had a chance to kind of experience it ourselves. And I don't want to speak for my other co-host, but it was awesome. Like, it was just a great, refreshing, kind of new experience in a video game that I haven't seen before. So thank you for sending that through.
Well, thank you for liking it. The thing is, I've been working on it for so long and I get surprised every time somebody tells me that they love it.
And so, oh, sure. So you see all the little errors and little things that we don't even notice, whereas we're just like, oh my god, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, it's difficult to detach yourself from your work. Yeah,
sure,
absolutely.
Yeah, well, tell us just by way of starting, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then a little bit about the game that you're working on.
Okay, well, my name is, well, officially it's Sherida.
Ha.
Ha. So that's how you say it. but. Yeah, so I'm a game developer from the Netherlands, and I'm 28 years old, and I graduated a few years back from college with a degree in video game design and development. And most of my education was very much based around, well, like most games are made, so very much in teamwork, tackling projects. A lot of people in the Dutch industry work on serious games, so games for applied for, you know, healthcare or education, that sort of thing. And there are also quite a bunch of indie studios. For me, it was very much that I love video games, but not so much in the state that they are now, but more, you know, the idea of what they could be. So this medium of communication, artistic views of creators. So, yeah, with that in that light, I decided to, you know, go a different route and start making games by myself instead of, well, as a team effort. So I graduated in 2011 with a very early prototype of the game that became Beyond Eyes. Even though it was called Beyond Eyes, it was very different at the time. And I started just, you know, working, doing art, learning myself how to code, because that was definitely something that I had no experience with. And I came very much from a visual and gameplay design background. So started working and learning things to make it all come together.
Nice. And so did you, like, when you were 4 years old, were you like, I want to be a game designer? Or when did you kind of realize you wanted to go into video games?
No, absolutely not. And I think this is maybe not as common. Like, a lot of people I know who work in games became game designers because of, you know, the work that the games that they used to play and, like, the fun memories they had. I played games as a kid, like most of us did, but not... It wasn't my main hobby. I was very much a theater kind of kid, so I did a lot of musicals, plays. I wrote a lot of stuff. I like drawing. So for me, I always knew I would end up in a creative industry, but I always thought that industry would be either film or theater. And then when I was around 19 or 20, it took me a while to figure things out. because I graduated from high school a couple of years before, and I was constantly trying on things and, you know, not feeling very comfortable with it. So I decided that year I would either, you know, go for to do a musical theater education or something else. And I went looking for art schools that would provide such a theater program. Mm-hmm. And I came to the college that I finally attended, and they had a lot of different types of education. So I went to their, like, open day, like open house, and I really didn't like the vibe. And I also I felt a little bit unsure there, like what I could, you know, add to that particular field. So I will want to be more a creator than being an actor or, you know, something like that. Yeah. So I started working. I decided, well, let's focus on something else. Let's try to, improve my visual design skills. So I applied for a photography course in the same college. I got in, didn't really like it, but I really liked the school because it had such a nice atmosphere with all these people doing really crossovers of awesome things. And so I thought, like, again, this is nothing for me. I'm just going to get, like, the school, the program guide and see what else they have. and then I had the game design and development course. And then they had this little, like, summary, like, oh, if you like, you know, drawing, like, storytelling, you know, like, the whole interactive medium idea, then maybe this is something for you. I was like, yeah, you know, I never thought about it, but it definitely sounds like a place where a lot of my passion and hobbies could be combined to do something, and to especially to innovate in a field that was, you know, very new, or very not necessarily new, but, you know, it had been stuck in a certain place for a long time. So I applied for the program with the idea of doing a lot of interactive theater to focus more on that area. But yeah, I really liked the digital games, of course, as well. And that's it. So it's a bit of a weird way of getting there.
That's cool.
I don't know that I've heard of a more straightforward route towards that. You know, like, it just, I empathize with that frustration of, okay, I know I want to make something. Which of these banners do I have to march under to actually make something?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Getting a little bit more into Beyond Eyes, we didn't really give a description of the game coming in here, but you play as a little girl who is blind, and the whole experience is a visual interpretation of how she experiences the world in non-visual ways, and it's very beautiful. Where did you get the inspiration for that concept? You know, is that informed by anybody in particular in your life? Have you worked with the blind or visually impaired, or was that just something that an idea that you just latched onto out of nowhere?
Yeah, it was. The thing is that I like finding new things, and I like exploring, and I have a couple of friends who are very. It's a quality that I really like in people, when they, you know, go beyond the obvious and they look for small things. So when, for example, I'm walking outside with my friends, they notice these little details, like, you know, a small bug on a fence, or like this beautiful flower hidden somewhere. And it's something that I truly enjoy. And at the same time, I always feel a bit sad that a lot of people don't necessarily have that quality anymore. They lose it, the kind of this curiosity and you know, this willingness to find new things and to be surprised by things and to be entertained or, you know, touched in a way by small things just by, you know, looking, using their senses. So I was talking with my friend about a possible graduation project, and we thought about, you know, all these like, how can we make this ultimate game of exploring? How can you force people to really take in the environment and go hunting for these little details that you know, would otherwise be overlooked? And yeah, so once we were started talking, like, all of a sudden we had this idea of, you know, why not make it about a blind girl, you know, and really try to focus on your other senses and filling things in, and also, you know, how something can be perceived completely different by somebody else who has a different state of mind or a different, you know, catalog of knowledge to pull from. Yeah, and that's actually where the base of Beyond Eyes was created.
That's awesome. And just to let you know that your objective is working, we have another host. His name is David, who's actually on vacation right now. But he played the demo because he thought he might be able to join. And I got a text from him, and he's like, chickens! I found chickens! And he was so excited. He just thought it was so cool that he stumbled upon chickens, like, and something as small and as insignificant as that. Again, something that, you know, would be overlooked. He was just, it just, you know, made his day. So
yeah.
It's working, at least to some extent.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's wonderful how you put those barriers in place. You know, like when you leave her garden, which is, you know, a known place, it is something that she is navigating by memory, right? And you're walking out into the void, putting those barriers up allows unexpected things like chickens to, you know, to rise higher, you know, in people's attention than they otherwise would. And, you know, this seems like, you know, a game that is kind of predicated on, you know, the delight of surprise, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it totally lends itself to Easter eggs. Yeah.
Guys, I found Easter eggs.
Exactly, yeah.
No. I always feel like that when I find real Easter eggs.
Except when it's October.
There's going to be, like, I'm working on the other levels right now and also extending. There's so many stuff to be found, and it, well, I don't know, I feel like I want to know what people will find, and I'm just so excited for that thought.
I mean, for me, this was Flower Finder 2014. Like, every time I saw that little wisp of scent, I was like, gotta get it.
So you've mentioned that Ray is not supposed to just be an avatar that you tell what to do, and she does it. Could you speak a little more about what you want the player's relationship with Ray to be?
Yeah, of course. It's always a bit difficult to explain, but the thing something that always struck me as very odd is that even in games where, like, for example, I really enjoyed Aiko, and the thing that I always found weird that is that you can miss jump, and, you know, the guy just falls off a cliff, and then you start again at the bench where you're at your last saving point. And I always
thought that
idea that that something was missing there, you know, the opportunity to not wanting that protagonist to befall any harm. And that for me was something that I always toyed with through different concepts, like, how can you let a player connect with a character that, you know, he wants to keep, or she wants to keep the protagonist safe and care for them. And how can you enforce a bond that goes beyond that point? I mean, of course, you know, if we see the cutscenes and we see the story, we still have this connection with the characters. But at the same time, we don't really feel that much of a responsibility for their happiness or their despair. It's just a lot of games really make us carry your character from point A to B, and you do that because the game wants you to. So if something bad happens to the character, it's part of the story, because the designers created this story and now the character is sad or bereft of something. And I really wanted to play with the idea of responsibility and also, you know, caring, having this relationship to an avatar that you would actually be responsible for their well-being and also, you know, feel good about being responsible for them. You know, like, for example, with Rey, she's kind of, she's traumatized and she's very scary. And the reason that she never left her her safe environment was because she was really unsafe and she doesn't really trust the outside world. So, you know, like the fact that she actually goes on this journey and allows you as a player to guide her is, for her character, is this huge step forward. It's a huge thing, and I really want the player to feel that impact and also see how she can become even more herself or more relaxed around the player just by having them treat her decently or nice or just, you know, allowing her to express herself. Does it make any sense? Or
It certainly does. I'm just trying to think of a thoughtful follow up question.
So how do you keep that from how do you keep that? Because I agree it's a great concept, and there is almost this kind of dissonance every time I run my guy off a ledge and he comes back just like, yeah, let's go, you know, run me off that ledge again. But how do you enforce that without it becoming frustrating to the player? Because, you know, 90% of the time I'm not intending to fail.
No.
And so, you know, I don't, you know, how do you keep it from feeling like you're being punished for failure disproportionately versus punished for being unfeeling towards your character?
Yeah, well, part of it is, of course, is very much in the balancing of the game, which is something that I'm working on very hard, of course. But the thing is that it's not, you know, if you just, you know, for example, if you, you know, take a wrong move and she just falls off a rock into the pond or something, that, you know, that shouldn't happen, or that could be an accident, you know, instead of, you know, you know, bad intent. So part of the things that I'm working on is the way that Rey's animated. So a lot of the time she will actually you know, communicate to the player very clearly if she's in a situation that she feels unsafe in, or that you know, that she doesn't really want to continue. So it actually, for the player to do something wrong and actually be, you know, punished for it, then you have to do some really mean things to her.
Yeah. So like, haha, I'm going to walk you into traffic or something like that.
Yeah, like, that's one of the things. Another thing is, for example, there are certain areas there is vegetation that is kind of like bramble bushes, so they kind of hurt her.
Oh, sure.
You know, like the first time she'd touch it, she'd be like, ouch, you know, like, meh. He was playing like, okay, let's touch it again. Then, you know, then there's a different sort of the dynamic going on, and then, you know, it will really, of course, it will upset her very much.
Gotta find the chickens.
Does it mean chicken? He chases you. Do you feel like it's a shortcoming of modern games that failure still equals death, or that, you know, the possibility of death or of, you know, disaster befalling somebody is really the only way to raise the stakes or provide, you know, consequences for not performing optimally?
I'm not sure if it's a shortcoming. I think the thing that I see most is that many designers, game developers in general, they do certain things because they feel that that's the way it should be, or that's the way it always has been. Mm-hmm. So they don't really question all the decisions that they make, because some of the things are, you know, have become like a staple, like a very standard thing to do in games, without them really questioning why you would insert it into your game. So maybe it's not like a bad thing, but maybe it's just sort of laziness or not really focusing on that aspect to see, yeah, what if you do something, if you add something to your game, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It just is a thing that people, you know, to do in games.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that designers in general would become more aware of the stereotypes that they reinforce time and time again.
Yeah. So, I mean, we kind of glossed over the actual, like, moment-to-moment gameplay in Beyond Eyes. But I think the thing that is really bold and striking for me is that for large portions of the game, your world can essentially be a blank canvas. You know, if Ray hasn't gotten close to it or, you know, touched it or smelt it, you don't see it. And I'm curious to what your approach was to having a world like that and making sure it feels full and feels alive, even though, you know, visually it's a blank canvas.
Can you repeat it once again?
Yeah, so how do you make the world feel full and alive and like it has stuff in it, even though visually you can't see anything most of the time?
It's a lot of experimenting. I've practiced a lot with it. I've had a few people playtesting it. The first few times it went completely wrong. and it still is, because the difficulty with this game is that it requires a lot of initiative from the player, and there are a lot of players who have been conditioned over the years that they're not supposed to go out and explore things, that the game will tell them when they have to go somewhere. Or the game will tell them, you know, oh, now you have to go fetch this, or now you have to, you know, go there. And so a lot of people, I noticed that a lot of people, when they start playing the game, the first thing they do is they try to find a corner. Like, and they just, like, walk around, try to, you know, walk around the engine.
I mean, it's scary to go out into the middle of the nothing, essentially. So you keep yourself to that corner because, you know, it's a wall. I can feel this. This keeps me grounded. Like, it's even though it's through a game, it's kind of really scary to step out into the unknown.
Yeah. Well, corners and walls define space, right? Like, if it's out there, there might as well effectively be nothing grounding you there. Like, yeah. I think a lot of players, especially in 3D space, because most of the 3D games we've ever played, are wondering, where is the bottomless pit here? You want to remain anchored to something in that corner and that wall, because I did that too. Like, when I had the path leading out in front of me that, you know, was filling in, but I saw that, you know, I'm going through a doorway, so a doorway implies a wall on either side. Instead of following the path, which would have led me to more interesting things, I actually took a hard right and just followed that as far as I could. Yeah,
it's like the maze approach. Put your hand on the right side of the wall and just go. Yeah.
It's amazing, clever. It's a clever approach, but I hope that. As time goes by, people, you know, see it and they think, like, okay, I've mapped out the area, now I can just slowly start.
Well, yeah. I think the biggest reward is kind of striking out into the middle of the map, because for me, the most beautiful moment in the game for me was I had been exploring for a while, I'd gotten away from the wall finally, and then I turned around and saw the landscape of where I'd been for the first time. And it just, my jaw dropped, because I was in a completely different place than I thought I was. There was this beautiful wandering trail going out, you know, from where I'd been. And it was, you know, the space was a lot bigger than I'd imagined it to be. So that was just a real moment for me to turn around and see that.
Nice. Yeah, I think the jaw-dropping moment for me is when I started to hear the river. And once I realized that sound would play a very significant role in the game, I thought that was really cool. You could gradually hear that coming in and then navigate with it too.
Yeah. Cool.
That notion of looking back at your, you know, kind of winding memory path, for lack of a better way to say it, you know, it's kind of like the character herself as a paintbrush, which plays into the watercolor visual style. You know, how did you settle on this, you know, this particular look for the game, which is really beautiful?
Thank you. The thing is, I like the hand-drawn look, and I've been waiting for games to incorporate it. And I thought, like, yeah, why aren't there more games that, for example, when I first saw the Borderlands artwork, I was like, yes, finally, you know, games this sketchy approach to 3D, and I really like that. But I really missed that idea of, like, having flowing water paint, and I really wanted somebody else to do it, to make a game. Never happened. Then I started working on the game, and I realized why, because, you know, it's pretty heavy, and it took me long time to figure out how to make it efficient enough to run on a computer that was, you know, a normal computer. And it really fitted well with the idea, because for me, like, this idea what I had when I started working on Beyond Eyes was, you know, like, stuff starts flowing out and you touch something, and, you know, and around your hand, like, things magically appear, like, in a very swirly kind of way. And I had a friend, and she and I actually started working on Beyond Eyes together in our graduation, for a graduation project. She's a writer and an artist, and she works primarily with watercolor. And she was making, you know, this concept art, and I saw, you know, like, every time she placed her brush on the paper, like, stuff started flowing out, and I was like, oh, that's, I need to find a way to, you know, in the game itself. So we worked on it for a couple of weeks, you know, the initial idea, getting it out. She eventually, well, we split ways because she really wanted to focus more on being a game writer. So she created a sort of an interactive fiction based on the same idea about a blind girl exploring her surroundings. So, and I started, I continued working on Beyond Eyes, but I really kept her initial drawings as a sort of starting point of how I wanted the game to become.
So outside of technical skills that you had to develop, did you need to do any research on blindness when developing this game? And, like, what kind of research did you need to do?
I did, because, well, when I started working, it was a graduation project, so I needed to, you know, get my research done. The thing that I found out very quickly is that blind people don't see things in watercolor in their mind. It's basically, it's kind of a, somebody described it to me, like, try to imagine that there are eyes in the back of your head, and that's basically what it's like to be blind. There's just this whole nothingness there. So even though I did, you know, do a lot of research on how blind people navigate, how they use, you know, their other senses, how they use echolocation, how they, you know, manage to be independent in their daily lives, actually quite a little, not much of that actually comes through in the final game, because the truth is that it's not as glamorous as I make it out to be.
I tried,
and the thing is, the first time I started, I made several prototypes back then, and one of them was in this really weird, it was very much based on other senses, and a lot more, it was very dark and, like, very gritty and very texture-based game, and it probably would have been very interesting, but it kind of missed the thing that Beyond Eyes is all about now, you know, exploring. It was more of, like, a simulation of how to use your other senses than having this story about a girl, you know, venturing out by herself on this journey, exploring the world around her.
Yeah. I'll speak to my experience with this. For a couple of years towards the end of college and shortly after, I worked at the Center for the Blind here in Cincinnati, Ohio. It was like a radio station that did reading, you know, for the clients of the organization. And as part of that, you know, we had to do orientation, and a large number of the employees that we worked with as well were blind and visually impaired. And as part of that, you know, you have to kind of get used to seeing the world through their eyes in a certain way, which is you have blindfolds on. And when you're getting volunteers up to speed, you plop blindfolds on them and you give them the walk around the building with somebody providing, you know, acting as a guide. And, you know, the sense of going through this area in the game actually did kind of echo very well with that. And I saw, you know, a little bit of what's happening, which is you do rely on a certain familiarity with the space around you. In order to get around, you know, when you're like that, and that, you know, is supported by conversations with people like that. So it feels like you actually did nail it to a certain extent.
Oh, that's cool. But the thing is, I like I said, I have no experience with, you know, being blind myself. There is a museum, however, in the Netherlands that offers kind of the same experience you're talking about. So people go in there, they, you know, get blindfolded, and you walk around through different areas, you know, crowded areas, like a little urban area. There's a bar, there, you know, there's a house, and they kind of explain through the, going through the motions with you, like, okay, this is how you know, when there is a sidewalk, or this is how you, you know, measure doors, or this is how so that was kind of for me it was interesting. So that was kind of the only experience I had. I did walk around with a blindfold as well for a couple of days, just, you know, getting nice. it's always very much my own experience plus like stories from other people, so there's no scientific background or whatsoever. But I'm glad that you you it also feels like you know, a sincere experience.
Yeah. Does she eventually find a dog?
A cat.
Oh, what's a cat? Okay.
It's a cat.
Ah, gotcha. Oh.
Oh,
yeah. I hope so. I really care about her. I want her to be happy.
So do I. Okay.
Yeah.
She gets what she needs. Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't wait to find out. So, you know, you talk about all the different challenges. What has been the most challenging piece of this whole process?
It's such a difficult project to work on. No, it really is, because like a lot of the things that I do with me, you know, either gameplay wise or, you know, visually wise, it's very it's kind of innovating. So there's not a lot of, for me, there's not a lot of information or like similar work that I can go through to get inspiration or, you know, to get things right. So yeah, that's, for me, that's the most difficult part, like finding creating a framework for myself to work in. I love this project. Personally, I sometimes still think that it would have been better for my, you know, my mental state had I waited a couple of more years to work on it, because it's a huge project, and you know, it wants to do so many things new, and it wants to do so many things right. So, but yeah, creating that framework, finding a narrative for myself, you know, creating that backdrop to fall back on. That's the biggest challenge for this game.
I don't know if you have the same term in the Netherlands, but there's kind of a poetry to the fact that you are working in a literal white space and a figurative white space.
Yes. Yes, for me, like it's in a way, it's very much the same. Like you describe it, for me, it's like I sometimes feel like I'm going nowhere, and then I have no idea what I'm doing, and it feels very immense. And then I look around and I see what I've made, and how it's coming together, and how things are falling into place, and I get this, you know, this feeling of wow, I'm doing something good, and I'm getting there. But for a lot of the time, it feels really like, you know, stumbling in that white space.
That's interesting that you have a similar impression of the project that you get when you're Ray walking and then looking back at everything that you've done. But yeah. Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, you're doing this all by yourself, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yes. Yeah, that is amazing. That is simply amazing.
Yes, it is. It also feels like a very stupid thing, but oh, I'm highly ambitious. Like, you know, if somebody else would tell me about this project and then ask me, like, okay, can you, you know, make a schedule? Like, how many people do you think it would take? Like, how much time would you calculate for things? Like, yeah, this is at least like a 4 or 5 person project, and you're gonna need some time. You know, you're gonna need some resources. So yeah, it's insane, but at the same time, I really like it, because I can do anything. Like, everything is pretty much, you know, created from my vision.
Yeah.
It's a huge luxury to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's at your whim. I have such tremendous respect for people who do endeavor to do that themselves. Just because games are so multidisciplinary. I mean, you're aware of this coming from the project side of it. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, if you're just sitting down to write write a novel, that's an act of solitary madness, right?
Yes.
but it's still writing. You are a writer. But you're handling the graphics and the sound and programming and even, like, the administration. of this whole thing, keeping the project running. Like, just all of those are such disparate skill sets, you know, and you're a team of one. So that is just tremendously impressive to me.
Yeah, kudos.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. So kind of speaking to that administrative part of this, can you talk about the process of crowdfunding? Because you had the Indiegogo campaign running, last year. What made you decide to go that route? And how was that experience for you?
Well, I was very naive. That's for certain. That's one thing. No, the thing was that I really wanted to start working on the game. And there was some funding for me available, but it didn't really work out. So I thought, like, yeah, okay, what am I going to do now? Either I, you know, find a way to focus on this project for full time, because it's not a project that I try to. The thing is, I graduated in 2011, and I started working full time on the game in early 2013, so last year. In the time between, I worked on the game, but I also had a side job, and, you know, I was exploring my skills, like developing the skills necessary to make this game, and it felt like completely overwhelming. So this project took a lot of my time. I had, like, I worked 30 hours a week on another job, then I still managed to work full-time on the game, so I had no time off whatsoever. So there was this realization that either I'm going to do this project full time, or I need to stop working on it, because I'm not going to do it justice, and I'm not going to, you know, have a very happy, healthy life. Something that is very important for me, and for me, it's always been very important to find this balance between, you know, working life and life in general. So have a balance. So I thought about crowdfunding. And one of the first things, like I said, I was very naive in that way. I thought, like, as long as you have an original story to tell, people, you know, will find it. So I set up a crowdfunding campaign. I started, you know, emailing all these different outlets and trying to get people interested. And there were a lot of positive reactions to it. But I also realized that making a game and also doing PR marketing by myself as well, it's a full-time job. It's another full-time job.
you're preaching in the choir.
Yeah.
So after the project, I talked to a guy who became a friend of mine later, Dan, and he has his own PR firm. He's like, yeah, you know, this, you just need to do what you do best, and next time, from now on, I'm just going to handle that part of your business, which for me was a huge relief after that. But before that, it was, you know...
three full-time jobs.
Yeah, it was so overwhelming. So in the end, I did the crowdfunding campaign, and I got a little under 50%. So that was, for me, was enough to cover a couple of months' work.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. But crowdfunding was nice. I mean, it was the first time for me that I, you know, let other people know of this project I'm working on, because I'm just like a chicken on an egg. I'm just constantly trying to keep it safe and to shelter it and to, you know, keep it close to myself. And first time I had, I let other people play the demo, I was so nervous, because it felt like completely out of control. And we said it earlier, like, you see the tiny details, and I see all the things that I wanted to add in a different way. So,
yeah,
all the things I wanted to change. But for that, crowdfunding was really useful, because it, you know, it exposed got a lot of exposure, and a lot of people know the game now. Like, even if I'm not actively promoting it, with the visual style being unique as it is, people, you know, they see the game and they remember it. So whenever I come somewhere and they're like, oh, what you doing? And I tell, like, yeah, I make this game about a blind girl. Like, oh, yeah, I've seen that game. So that's
oh, that's so cool. But,
yeah, it actually, you know, they remember. So that's a good thing for me.
So, yeah, going back to the game a little bit, I wanted to ask, do you have an opinion on how women are portrayed in video games? And has that influenced your game design at all?
No, it has not influenced my game design at all. okay, so this for me is always kind of a tricky subject. I mean, it's very, it's a very common thing. And of course, it makes sense for a lot of people to ask me because I'm a woman developing games, like how I feel about, you know, women's place in games and the portrayal and the industry itself. I found a difficult question because I'm not very much on the shouting side of things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do have some strong opinions about it, but for me, the thing is that, do I feel that women are portrayed in a silly way in video games? Absolutely. But the same goes for men. You know, so for me, like, there's a lot of things are wrong with the way people are portrayed in video games, because a lot of time they're not portrayed as people, they're portrayed as, you know, stereotypes or tropes.
Yeah.
So definitely so much room for improvement on that area. on every side of it. So for me, I wanted to create a character that, you know, that fit the narrative. Like I said, I worked on a prototype before, and originally, Ray was actually a young woman around 17 or 18 years old. But, well, as I started working on the project, she really didn't fit the narrative. There is a reason that most of my characters are girls, but it's mostly because it's some place that I'm familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not a very extreme experienced writer, and I really feel like, as a starting point, I want to write characters from a point of view that is a little bit closer to me before I start branching out and doing different stuff. So, yeah, for me, that's the reason that that Ray is a girl. But
it's,
otherwise, yeah.
It seems to me that she's not defined by the fact that she's a girl. She's defined by her youth.
Exactly.
You know?
It could have been a boy, but it could have been a girl as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, why not?
It's a coin flip. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, you know, in my mind, she always was a girl for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I love your point that, you know, yes, there's a problem with portraying women in video games, but there's a problem portraying humans in video games.
Yeah.
And so many fail to, you know, create real people that you could engage with the way that, you know, movies and novels and stuff like that have, you know, kind of really focused on. Games have such power and such potential for going even deeper than novels and movies. But it feels like we've almost gotten distracted with all those other interactive things and forgotten that core of humanity that will really engage people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's a shallowness problem.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And so one other question I also have is, were there any video games that served as inspiration for this game?
It's okay to say no.
You mentioned Eco a little bit earlier.
Yes and no. I mean, there's no, there's not a one single video game that, you know, inspired me to create Beyond Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is one video game, or like a couple of video games, that inspired me to, you know, take this path of making the kind of games that I want to make. Most importantly for me, it was a Belgian company called Telltales. They've created games like The Path, Graveyard. And for me, that was the first time that I actually came into contact with games that did something completely different and more in the lines of what I thought games could be. So for me, that was this huge aha moment that I thought, like, yes, actually, you know, there's a branch I can grab onto. There's a new way I can go in, and that, you know, that partly aligns with the things I want to accomplish. Because before that, I just had this idea, like, the things that I want to make, is it even possible? Especially because I come from, like, the game design. Even though I went to an art school, we had a game design program. It was very much focused on the more traditional kind of video games. So a lot of times the school itself would pretty much, you know, start to, they wouldn't really encourage me to proceed this path because they thought, like, yeah, that's just, you know, some artsy-fartsy stuff to go, you know, it's not real gaming, you know. Why don't you go to a different school, that sort of thing.
Mm.
So, yeah, for me, that was it kind of set me on the way to make these sort of games. But like a direct influence? Not really. No, for me, I'd say my inspiration comes a lot more from different media.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for ignoring all the haters. And
I mean, in a way, them saying, why don't you make real games, put you on the path that you're on. Like, they did motivate you, just not in the way they intended.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So other than, you know, just inspirations, what games are you playing right now? Do you have time to play any games? And are there any other games that you would recommend that our listeners check out?
Oof. The last game that I played was Watch Dogs. I haven't played a whole lot of it. I like the idea, although the thing about making video games, and I noticed that the minute I started my education, was that it's very difficult to enjoy video games to start making them, because, you know, there's all this extra knowledge. You're constantly comparing. You're looking for technical things or too much of a creator mindset when you play these games. But I played Watch Dogs. I liked it. I'm really looking forward to Dragon Age Inquisition. So yep. I'm kind of planning my whole development cycle around the release. I gave myself 1 week for the release.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. and the thing is, like, there aren't that many games that I get really excited about. I'm hoping for them. I'm still desperately hoping that The Last Guardian will ever be released.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, so my hopes are kind of, you know, going down every year. That
7 years now.
So horrible. And you know, you see the spare footage that has been released over the years. You just know that something's gonna make you dead. They're gonna, you know, grab you with the feelings and just it must be such a good game, but it's not being released. So I have a few games that I'm looking forward to. One of the games I'm really looking forward to is the game you did a podcast on that as well, Dead Dragon Cancer.
I
finished that off. So that's one that I'm really, really looking forward to, because every time I hear something about it or I see footage, like, my eyes just start tearing.
They've done a great job.
Yeah, that demo took a chunk out of me.
I listened to your, I heard your podcast about it. But that sort of thing is really something that, how heartbreaking it may be and how horrible in a way it might be, those personal stories, that's something that video games really need. Like, this human aspect, this idea that, that, you know, the ability to be immersed in stories like that, and games need that, and they can totally handle it. People just need to start making more personal games, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So other things that I've been playing, I always like to play Skyrim.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we've installed it here with like over 100 mods, and I always enjoy that. Something to go to and, you know, to walk around and explore, and it's the same, yeah, for me it's the same way like taking a walk on the beach. Like, I take a walk in Skyrim.
That's great.
It's sort of relaxing atmosphere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for kind of leading this charge into more emotional games. You've definitely stepped into deep water, into a white space. And it's amazing to see what you're doing. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for talking to me. I had a great conversation.
Yeah, this was a great time. Where can we find you? I would love to just give you the opportunity to just plug for our listeners, you know, where they can find you, where they can find out more about Beyond Eyes and anything else you might be doing in the future.
Okay. So there's a website for Beyond Eyes. The website of the game is beyondeyes-game.com. I also post a lot of things about it on my Twitter, which is shirida-eh, which is like S-H-E-R-I-D-A-E-H.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Did I spell it correctly?
I believe so. We'll put it. I'll put it in the show notes as well.
Sounds, yes, yeah. That should be fine. And also, there's a Facebook page which I don't update as frequently as I like, but I'm getting there.
Yeah. Cool.
Great. Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time, and I feel like I've learned a lot about the game and about the process.
Yeah. Cool.
The grind. There's one post-interview comment I wanted to make.
Yeah.
Is that I worry that David is going to be depicted as, like, Lenny to her and from her perspective, because the only comments we made about him was that he really liked the chickens.
Can you, okay. We interrupt her in the middle of every answer she gives. Say, okay, but what's this have to do with the chickens? Like, yeah, I know you were talking about, like, just kind of the difficulties of, you know, serving multiple roles in this project and how, but, like, how did that affect your depiction of the chickens in the game?
What was your inspiration for the chickens?
Tell me about the chickens, Sherida. Title.
David has many other redeeming qualities besides loving chickens.
All right.
Noted fowl enthusiast David Money. That's his lower third on the news.
Yeah.
Wow. So I liked that interview. We hope you did as well.
Yeah. She seemed very nice.
Yeah.
And insane, because she's doing all of that work herself.
God, I really empathize with a lot of that stuff, especially talking about, like, oh, I realized I was doing 3 full-time jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Take vacation. I will start new projects. Yep.
That's a thing that happens.
You're about to have a baby? Why don't you start trying to learn acoustic guitar?
Yeah, and just pick it up. You can write soothing lullabies.
Yeah.
Just as long as they all lullabies are to the tune of Crash by Nick Matthews.
Yeah. This little lullaby goes plink plink. Hold on, wait, almost got it. Plink plink. Ah, fuck it. Good night.
Plink plink, damn it, wait.
It's my favorite children's book.
Plink plink, damn it, wait. Is plink plink the name of the character? He's Samuel. Really impatient.
Yeah.
Damn it, plink plink, wait.
Yeah.
Okay, another title.
What was the I feel like I've talked about this every other show, children's book narrated by Samuel L. Jackson, which is the fuck to sleep.
Go to fuck to sleep.
I might have to get a copy of that. Good stuff.
Oh man. But it's time for the grind, where we talk about the things we have been playing. And since it has been so little time, this might be pretty slight as well.
It's been a weekend.
Yeah, pretty much. So does anybody have something they want to lead with?
So I can start with my wormhole segue from 40 minutes ago. So we were talking about how PlayStation Network and Xbox kind of suck with how they manage selling things on their network, where you have to give them money and then there's always residual money. Mm-hmm. So my way of getting around that this last week was buying the BioShock Season Pass through Amazon and kind of circumventing giving them my credit card information. So,
nice.
But I realized that in talking about that, I'm also outed on the fact that I forgot to use the Amazon link. So my apologies.
That's fine.
But I haven't started it yet. I downloaded it overnight last night. So I will soon play Burial at Sea and then listen to the rest of the podcast.
Oh, yeah, because he couldn't join us.
Yeah.
Oh.
And play Clash in the Clouds as well.
Should I play that before Burial at Sea?
No, play it as a nice little palate cleanser after you get through all the heavy stuff in Burial at Sea. But it is we didn't really talk about it on the show, and it is very good.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will go in alphabetical order then with the DLC.
Huh. Okay.
That's all I got.
By buying something on Amazon?
Buying something on Amazon. It was a great game. Ninja Rush. I also went to part of Evo over the weekend. I'm going to go to the rest of that after the podcast today. But that's I don't know if I mentioned that last week or not. But,
no, yeah, and I'd love to hear about it now that you've actually been there. Like, what's the atmosphere like? What did you see? That sort of thing.
It was interesting. It's hard to describe. I don't want to offend any sort of type of populations or whatever. One thing that was really interesting is, like, so some entire families came to the thing. So they basically flew across the country so that their kids could compete at this, which that was something that I did not expect. So that was really cool. It does very much seem like almost like dorm life, where, like, everyone's really excited. They're all staying at the same hotel. And so there's, like, a lot of, like, cross chatter about, like, who they're going to play as and, like, what games they're going to play in and stuff. So it seemed like a really nice communal experience so far. So
That sounds remarkably positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't mean to shit all over it, but it was great.
Yeah. No.
I would expect it to be exciting because, I mean, you're going there as a spectator, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes, correct.
like how are they set up? Do they have, like, auditoriums where people are playing and you're watching it? Is, like, conference rooms? Like what's the actual layout of the show?
So, I mean, it's similar. It's the same setup as any other, like, Vegas hotel where they just have huge conference rooms. Mm-hmm. So the first night that we were there, there was also, like, a Elvis slow dancing conference in one of the rooms. So you could very easily pick out who was going to which conference. there's no ambiguity. But, so it's just set up conference style in a hotel. But, yeah, they're just gigantic rooms. And so they have screens posted of, you know, like, what people are playing and giant, you know. It's basically like an auditorium, so there's a bunch of chairs set up so you can watch it.
Cool.
But
that reminds me, last year, the year before, I forget which one, the Portland Retro Games Expo was running concurrent with like a daddy daughter purity dance. Creepy, but you could really tell who was going with to which.
Yeah.
So which conference was more outdated than, I don't know.
Well, the morals of one, the technology of the other. I'll leave you to guess. I mean, any standout games? I mean, I know you're a Smash Brothers fan, like, so were you sticking mainly to those corridors, or have you expanded your horizon?
So I only went on the opening night. Today is, like, the official final tournaments.
Okay.
So I do not have – I will have more to report on this, like, next week, basically. Yeah.
Okay.
I haven't seen the intense competition yet.
So you went the first night and did not see a single fighting game played?
Yes.
it's about the environment,
just,
right?
It was set up, man. Everyone was just excited to be there. There was they have, like, similar conferences where there's, like, booths for different games being set up. Yeah, but that's about it.
I went just because I was thinking about it. I went back and watched the final matches for last year's Evo in a couple different games, and my God, just the atmosphere, even pre-recorded and everything, was intense. And as fun as watching any, you know, well, I would say more interesting than watching those boxing matches that I've seen.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We get a lot of people, or there's a contingent of listeners who really wish we would talk about fighting games more, or would lean away from kind of like our usual stint of focusing on narrative and games. And it kind of, like, to us, like, it doesn't feel like that's the kind of podcast we are, but that, like, I'm definitely more interested in the culture that surrounds that than in the games themselves, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think for my question, we did a multiplayer a while back about, like, what is the game or type of game that you would, like, invest in if you had the time. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's definitely, like, I love everything about fighting games. I am just horrible at them and would need to invest so many hours to get good, at least I think. That you know, it's almost this precipice that I can't get myself to jump off of.
Yeah.
But I'm trying. PlayStation All-Stars represent.
I was gonna say you should just have Jen teach you.
Yeah, she is teaching. I'm getting schooled. That is for sure.
I wasn't laughing at the notion of a lady being good at games. I was laughing because you framed that as a burn.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I'm excited to hear about the finals. So be sure that we're back on that next week. Dennis, how about you?
Yeah, so the aforementioned PlayStation All-Stars, still going strong there, still having my ass handed to me in versus mode. but we've started kind of working our way through all the arcade modes and learning all the different characters. And that's a lot of fun. Like, the way to have, for me, the way to have fun playing those games is when you're just choosing a different character every time. And so we've talked about the whole, you know, Fox only, Final Destination, no items mindset and how much that kills fun. But it's, you know, I've never played Smash Bros. Extensively. So to really see that borne out in PlayStation All-Stars is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Just because it's, you know, mixing up and trying to remember the character's moves and then, you know, finding their strengths versus the other character's weaknesses. And it just makes things really, really interesting. And the depth doesn't necessarily come from having these really hard to execute combos. The depth comes from, you know, thinking about what's in your arsenal versus what's in your opponent's arsenal and then trying to execute versus that. Still getting through that execution part, but it's a ton of fun.
Yeah. I mean, is it like Smash Brothers where everybody has an up B move and everybody has some semblance of a grapple and the variety comes from what those different animations are? Or is it like, I know that if I'm playing as Ken, I do down forward this, and if I'm playing as Blanka, I tap a lot. Because when I play different characters in Smash Brothers, the inputs don't change, but the results do.
It's very interesting, and again, it's someone who's more familiar with the rule set could speak with authority, but in my experience, you know, the inputs will have the same generic effect. So like, hey, you know, this is my, you know, tapping square will do your basic attack, you know, just forward, and, you know, hitting down in triangle will do some kind of smash move. However, there is variance within the characters of what exactly that does. So like, you know, for Big Daddy, your triangle forward attack is this big dash that covers a lot of ground. Whereas for Sly Cooper, it's much more localized. And he'll actually, I think it's the triangle forward move, he'll do a dash forward that doesn't do any attack, but will leave a trail of electricity behind him that will hurt anyone who's on the ground. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of the same concept, same general type of deal. But very plays out very differently because there are some characters where, you know, their strongest attacks or their you know, everyone's strongest attacks are on different places. If that makes any sense. I'm not sure if that's clear.
I mean, yeah, just they emphasize different styles.
Yeah, and it's like with this character I want to mash triangle, with this character I just want to abuse square and forward. And it's not like it's not templatized, which I don't imagine that Smash Bros. Is either. But you kind of there is a language that all the characters speak, just different dialects of the same language.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. I like that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, good work, Dennis.
Yeah, I've also been diving hardcore back into XCOM.
Hmm.
And our interview with Adrian just got me thinking about it. I'd beaten the main game just on regular, and then started several different runs. One was just upping the difficulty to impossible, which is just like it sounds. And then the other was, I was like, I wonder if I go back and I play the game on easy, which is not easy, if I could beat the game using only one soldier.
Oh, wow.
I remember this.
And so by nature of the way the game plays, I had to have a roster of soldier, because if you get hurt, which you're going to if you're playing with one soldier, that soldier is wounded for a certain number of days. So I had a roster of more than one soldier, but I would only ever send one soldier into battle at a time.
Okay, so you had choice between like sniper and heavy and stuff like that then?
Yeah, and all of them were viable, which surprised me. Like, you know, every class had its arguments for why you should play as that, as
even support.
Player. Even support. The gas smoke. Grenade. The smoke grenade was very useful. They also have 3 med kits, which is once you level them up and you can get that perk where instead of carrying one, they'll carry 3, and that is essential for surviving multiple battles. It basically makes it so you can be much more risky while you play. You know, the heavy has the early perk that lets you fire on both turns, and they also have the rocket, which can take out multiple groups. The assault has the running gun, which allows you to especially when you start going up against chrysalids, allows you to dash away from them, and then set up an overwatch, which is essentially how you beat chrysalids with only one soldier, which takes a lot of time. But it's cool. For those listening, a chrysalid is like a melee character, which is really powerful, but it has to be right next to you to attack.
And they're terrifying.
They are horrifying. So I went back to that one and played it to the point where I was able to develop robotic counterparts. And then that kind of puts, it's playing with one soldier is a huge puzzle for the first third of the game. And then once you get to the point where you can develop, drones, essentially, then it becomes just like, you know, the rest of the game, and you can use the drones as stand-ins for other soldiers. So that's kind of the point where I was like, okay, I don't need to finish this because I know I could win it now. So that was a lot of fun. And then I started playing the game on classic mode, which is the second highest difficulty, on Iron Man, which means that you are not allowed to load previous saves. You're on one save, and it saves after every single turn. And it is amazing and infuriating all at the same time. Just the game is so perfectly balanced at that point where literally one wrong move will ruin a mission for you. And the great thing and the horrible thing about XCOM is every time you make that wrong move, you immediately know how you could have done it better. And it's like, I got too aggressive. I know exactly where I should have gone instead of there. I should have seen that in advance, or, you know, just something like that. So I've done, let's see, I'm up to game 12 now. So I have done, 9 attempts at the run. I've made it out of the first mission about 6 times.
This should be like Super Meat Boy, where they keep track of all the different runs.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Show all the Earths at one time. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing I just cannot get through is the first Terra mission. So it's the first mission where those chrysalids show up. Because not only are these things beasts that, like, if they get into melee range, they'll just wipe you out. Melee range? Melee? Melee.
Yeah.
Melee.
Whatever. That and Skyrim are the two words that I like. I'm always second-guessing myself on pronunciation. not only can they just wipe you out in one move if they get to you, but the way they wipe you out is they essentially turn whoever they're killing into a zombie. And that zombie will get up and itself can kill you in one hit if it gets to you within melee range. And then if you go 3 turns without killing the zombie will turn into another chrysalid, which can produce more zombies. And it's just, especially on missions where you're trying to save civilians, and there's just, you know, 12 civilians scattered throughout the map, they're going to get to some civilians before you. Those civilians will likely turn into zombies and then more chrysalids before you can get to them. And it's, I cannot figure out a way around it. So that's where I'm stuck. And it's probably a good, you know, 3 hours of play before you get to that point. So I'm not sure what my way forward is. I might try notching the difficulty down and going to Iron Man, or just looking up guides for how to survive it. I'm not sure, but it is very, very intense. 'Cause like I said, one wrong move, and you've blown it. So it's watching me play is probably incredibly boring, 'cause it's a lot of me like pacing in front of my TV and staring at the screen,
like going into your war room to consult with your generals.
I literally play this game standing up. Like it's that intense. But you know, so it's me pacing around in front of my, maybe that would be entertaining to watch. I don't know. And then, you know, one move every couple of minutes if I'm in a tough situation. But it is so much fun, and it's just, you know, it's a great way to experience that stress and pressure and all that stuff third hand, but still have it be a fun game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And other than that, I think that's what I've been playing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got 2 to talk about here very briefly, because I haven't spent a terrible amount of time with them. Okay, I've spent a terrible amount of time, but terrible in that not a lot. Ooh, self-burn. The first one I've been dipping my toe into is Gunpoint.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's the game where you're the little spy dude, and you're jumping around and doing the hacking and stuff. It's funny because so I've got this that is a Windows only game, and I've got this PC that that is sitting in my living room to play games on with controllers. However, that this is not a controller game; it is a mouse game, and it's been the thing that I've been testing Steam home streaming against, and I've not been getting the performance out of that I would like, just because Wi-Fi is not enough to to pass that signal through and without lag and without severely compressing that. So it's funny that in a game about rewiring buildings to make things happen for you, that was ultimately what got me to order 100 feet of Ethernet cable.
Holy shit.
Which isn't as much as you would think, both in length and also in price. Like, I got the flat kind from Monoprice off of Amazon for like $17, and then a roll of gaffer's tape, and I ran Ethernet from my office into the living room where that is at, and that'll help a bunch of other stuff. It'll help streaming and things. So like, it was an investment of like $30 to make the Steam in home streaming work better, and like, I can play Dark Souls off of that now. Because the signal's faster. Why I would do that, not in my living room, I don't know. But like, for a game like this where you want to have it run on Steam and you're sitting, you're sitting in your office on your Mac with the keyboard and mouse, works pretty well. So I just have an eyesore because gaff tape is black, and it is running along the baseboards. But whatever. But anyway, it's Gunpoint's pretty great. I like it a lot. I feel like it's been talked to death. They did an episode of Check It Out Comrade about it, and came out a while ago, so I don't have an awful lot new to say. I really like the perspective that it plays from, because it's it's side scrolling, but you're really zoomed out insofar as you can see the entire building at once, and that helps plan when you go into this wirejack mode where you are trying to figure out what you have to connect to what in order to make things happen. That helps to see it all at once. It is great for planning. It's like you're looking at a blueprint of this building as opposed to being real zoomed in. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty curve on it, like the stuff that it's trying to teach you, is actually really gentle. It doesn't introduce like multiple circuits that you have to take into account. Like, some are blue, red, and green, and they won't mix until pretty late on in terms of the tutorial level stuff. And puts you in situations that will naturally teach you about what you need to do. So guards will shoot you instantly, but you can trick them into like electrocuting themselves or locking themselves into rooms by rigging something bad to a light switch and then taking the turning off the lights on them. So when they walk up and they flip the switch, it's like, oh, that'll activate the outlet, which will shock them when they walk by it. Stuff like that are the things you're trying to do. So it's pretty great. I like the jumping. You kind of like charge it up and you see the arc of where you're going to go.
And, that's cool.
Yeah, and so you stick to walls and ceilings too. So that is a very novel way to get around.
So like Spider-Man style?
I mean, kinda. Yeah.
Spider-Man with a Y.
Well, I mean, like, is that like a paintball gun?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. But
good. What I understand is a lot of the fun in the game comes from having unforeseen consequences from all the rewiring that you're doing. It's hard to keep track of everything that you're changing in your head, and it's somewhat of a butterfly effect kind of deal. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, definitely. So I got an achievement for creating a short circuit, because you can make infinite loops inadvertently, because kind of like, okay, I don't need this thing anymore, but you don't get rid of the connection, because why would you, right? So as you're solving stuff, you're connecting a lot of things to stuff that's no longer useful, and if you're just looking for a place to put that connection or that line, you'll often create these things that will cause stuff to go haywire. So once you use something and it finishes its usefulness to you, it's no longer a thing that you need, you still have to take that into account, because it may ultimately mess you up later.
Nice.
Yeah, and there's like a nice mix of needing to be in a place physically to do something versus what can you do just remotely. That's pretty satisfying. Again, on this tip of like Watch Dogs and Ghost Trick Phantom Detective kind of thing.
Yeah,
kind of rolling with it. I'm not very far in. It's pretty cool because you take these missions and they all kind of start out with text messages. And the writing is pretty good and pretty funny. You can vary up your responses. I have no idea what impact that has, but I know that, you know, taking some missions precludes you from taking others because you're taking contracts from people who are working against each other in some cases.
So it's like the gangs in GTA 2.
Yeah, kind of. I'm not sure how the macro story is planning out. Each individual level is really just a series of puzzles, and it rates you on how quickly you do it, how quietly you do it, and your body count. And you can tell what the optimal things are. Those do it very quick, very quiet, with no body count. But you can get through it, you know, without being that perfect about it, which is pretty nice. It gives you that option.
So is it like Hitman, where every map has a potential for a perfect solution, where you don't kill anybody?
Maybe. I think that there are some where you're forced to kill, or there are some where you're forced to incapacitate them. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty brutal when you decide to take somebody out, which is you leap at them, which is the best way to do it because they're facing the other way a lot of the time, and you can see their cone of vision a little bit, and you pin them down. And kind of like Ralphie beating up Scott Farkas, you're just like wailing on them. And you see, you're pinning them down, just like punching them directly in the head. And like blood, you know, blood pixels come out. And then they're
like
just
Hotline
dead.
Miami.
Yeah, it's actually remarkably brutal for a game that otherwise is kind of chill, kind of cyberpunky noir feel. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's a little out of place. But it is satisfying in its way. Which is, they will die before you get to the blood point, however, or they will be incapacitated before you get to the blood point, but you find yourself clicking and clicking and clicking until no more blood comes out.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. So I dipped my toe into that. The other one that I've been playing is, I need to actually look at my notebook here, because I always forget the title of it when I'm about to talk about it. It is called Long Live the Queen. Yeah, so this is a game that was on the Steam sale. It's published by a company that primarily makes visual novels. They're Hanako Games, I believe. And what this is, I feel a little bit embarrassed that I have it, and it's kind of weird when it pops up that I'm playing it. However, I bought it because in the Something Awful thread about the Steam sale, like, people were saying, what the hell is this? And then there was a whole like line of people saying, if you don't buy this game because it's anime and it's about, you know, raising a little girl princess from girlhood to being, you know, her coronation, then you are dumb because it is a good game despite those trappings. Huh. It's like, huh, okay. And the way that it kind of shakes out is it's like Oregon Trail with stats.
Okay. Really?
So the premise is, you know, you've got this princess, and there's a, you know, anime as hell backstory about, oh, it's a magical kingdom, and there's political intrigue going on left and right, and her mother is assassinated, and that puts her next in line, and so you have a certain number of years and a certain number of essentially turns to kind of put her through her education in order to make sure that she is equipped to deal with the stuff that's going to pop up. And the Oregon Trail comparison, you know, comes from the fact that, you know, the base decision that you're making in most of these is, like, which class is she going to take? And there are different moods that affect how much return you're going to get from it. So when you start out, she's depressed, which means that she's probably not going to be very good at, like, learning straight up, like, facts, like, so history and, like, royal etiquette and stuff. But she's going to be really good at, like, expression and, like, animal handling and stuff. So it's a matter of playing to her mood in such a way that you get the most return on the things that you're that you're investing in, like the skill points. And then after those, there are all these like little challenges and encounters that happen where like something will pop up, like you'll see an owl fly over, and if you've invested points in falconry, you can say, huh, that's weird. That species isn't here during this time of thing. Oh, that actually might be part of a bigger plot to like pass messages around. And then that's used to inform this huge branching story that, that is placed here. Then there's also like you pick her classes, you do these little challenges, and you'll even see like where you fail by like, oh, you didn't know royal etiquette. So when this visiting dignitary came by, you know, you fail that. And then all of a sudden, well, we're not allied with them anymore. And so that completely changes what's going to come after here.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, and then you also have like the way to spend the free time, so it can be doing things that will affect the mood. So it's like, okay, I'm going to go, you know, so somebody just died, so I'm going to spend time in the chapel, and that will reduce my depression. Or like you can do things that are going to be good for you, you know, overall, but are kind of, you know, but that will come at a hit. So like, oh, I'm going to go sit in on court, which is going to suck, and it's going to make me feel, you know, depressed and also like really, really overstressed. But people seeing me do that will have positive effects later on. It's not an incredibly long game. Like these scenarios are only a certain number of turns, but it's a game that really seems built around the different achievements that you can get. So when you look at the list, you can see all these different outcomes, which are like, ooh, save the kingdom with your knowledge of medicine, or save the kingdom with X, Y, and Z. And it's like, okay, that actually does incentivize a little bit, because I can't imagine a scenario where studying falconry will benefit this. That just kind of seems like something you throw stats in. But apparently it does make a big difference.
Huh.
Yeah. And so, I mean, is it good?
Is there like no way to fail the game? It just depends on
you can straight up die. You can be dead as fuck.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And the thing they were talking about in the Steam thread is, pro tip, if you don't know where to put your skills, and you know, take medicine classes and focus on poisons, because people are always going to be trying to poison you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the way to fail is to die or to have the kingdom fall.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm looking at screenshots right now. It's got the kind of the one for like the mood. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, it's interesting because there's, you know, there's like cheerful and depressed and stuff that makes sense. And then there's a slider for angry and afraid. And like those two are opposite each other. That's interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's like there's one that's kind of uncomfortable, which is like, willful or meek or something like that.
Yielding. Yeah.
Yielding. And like, that's gross. Yielding is a really gross word, and that plays into like, ooh, are you going to be a nice little girl who takes her place or whatever? I'm uncomfortable with that aspect of it a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if that's a translation thing, or it could just be one of the icky things about
culture.
The game.
Like,
yeah, but to kind of have like, hey, how open are you to new information and experiences right now, mm-hmm. and using that as a determining factor in like you said, the type of stuff. So,
yeah.
You know, should you work on the stuff you're good at, or should you, you know, be trying new things right now?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, probably just a bit of an icky thing due to culture.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's pretty neat because ultimately it comes down to how do you optimize your stat gains based on the conditions that are in front of you. You know, like do you fight against those, you know, because if you start out depressed, and that can lead to a character that is like really good at painting and singing but like terrible at actually administering a kingdom. So, but you know, the,
like that one guy from Toronto.
A little bit. What? Oh, you mean Rob Ford? Yeah, yeah, no, he was really good at smoking crack. What is it with mayors and crack? Because the mayor of Detroit, he got popped on crack too, right?
Catch the wave.
catch the wave. Yeah, so it's really it's interesting. I'm a little bit put off by the aesthetic of it, but I can kind of put blinders to it and focus on the game. And I've always, you know, been down with those Oregon Trail. Like that's one of my favorite parts of FTL, which is, you know, the little random encounters that you get, like making that decision off of it. So this idea that you're, you know, you have stats that are governing things that are not usually, you know, statable, right?
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah. And those are the two. I would recommend it. It went on deep, deep discount on the Steam sale, and it's not a lot on Steam anyway. So as long as you have a very quiet, safe place where you can play it, where nobody's going to judge you, I would say go for it.
I'm going to go try and play it at Evo later today.
Yeah, competitive. Long live the queen. Oh man, princess only. Bear castle. No falconry. And that is nice. That is all. Any other questions about that?
No, very cool.
Cool. You guys want to button it up?
Word.
That was a very strained word.
Your voice kind of cracked in the middle of it.
Yeah, no.
Was that intentional?
No, it's time for breakfast. So yes, I am pro buttoning up.
Okay.
I
feel you. So I will button us up very quick. Yeah, so that was episode number 68 of The Level. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And an extra special thanks to Sherida for, you know, providing her time and her insight for that interview.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as we said during that interview, we're going to have links to all of her stuff in the show notes. Go check out Beyond Eyes and check out her stuff. We really recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Other than that, you know the stuff you can do. Like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/thelevelpodcast. There's also the website where you can find old episodes of the show. And if you feel like kicking us a couple bucks, it is the Patreon campaign, patreon.com/duckfeedtv. Anything I'm missing, guys? Tell a friend.
if you liked this episode and the BioShock episode, and you're newer to the network, go back into the archives, because we have a great interview with the developers of That Dragon Cancer. We also have an interview with one of the developers of Spec Ops The Line. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got several bonus levels just about various games that we didn't necessarily have an interview with. But I know The Walking Dead is on there. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple others as well. Yeah, I'm blanking on them.
The Gone Home episode has Zach Johnson from Video Games Hot Dog and Bob Mackey from Retronauts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that was while most of us were being really lazy about playing that game. We're like,
What do you mean?
Well, because we had a bunch of guests on there, and just like, I think you had played it, mm-hmm. and no one else on the, and you were like, guys, play this game, guys, play this game, guy. Okay, fuck it. Hey, anyone else want to do a bonus?
play this game, you assholes. Yeah.
And I finally did play it, and it was totally worth it. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
But yeah, an excellent episode. So yeah, I think there's a section on the site for bonus levels.
Yeah. There's a column. I'm really bad about keeping those lists updated, because that actually is like manual effort that goes into it.
Yeah, sure. I
wish that there was a way to automate it, but the bonus levels update less frequently than the main ones, so all of those are on there. So
yeah, they're in there, and it's a nice little palate cleanser from the normal. So yeah. we enjoy doing them. We hope you enjoy listening to them, and, mm-hmm. and keep an eye out for more in the future.
Yeah. And thank you, Dennis. You're the person who arranges these interviews. So you're out there killing it.
I'm good at bothering people on Twitter.
Cool.
And if anyone who's come on the show in the past to do an interview is listening, thank you guys.
Yeah. Awesome. So I'm Cole Ross, at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I'm Dennis Furia, at D Furia on Twitter.
I'm Ben Merkel, at Merkelizer on Twitter.
And David, who is not here, he is at MoneySmith777 on Twitter. And until next time, you know, just tell me about the chicken, Sherida.
And then the great thing about recording over Skype is that it is pre-recorded, so we're not live. And so if you're, you know, if you're unhappy with anything, if you, you know,
or
stumble over
language, yeah,
yeah, yeah, no, strong, yeah, and strong language is fine. We have that all the time on the show.
Okay.
Not that you have to, yeah, it's required. So
peer pressure. Yeah. Don't you want to be cool? Yeah.